So this evening I'd like to talk about working with thoughts in our practice. But to just start, I'd like to ask you how it was for you when I asked you to pay attention to your thoughts for the last 5 minutes of the sitting. I hope you could hear me. I didn't have the mic on. Yes.
I thought I was bombarded by thoughts until you said, watch your thoughts.
That can happen, you know. You start to kind of bring your attention in, and it's like they go hiding. Did you find any that came in the 5 minutes?
I definitely came back to where I lost count of them. What is this little moment?
I was
like, hey, where are they?
Thank you. Yeah.
I just had this really subtle flow of thoughts that seemed like it was non-countable. It was such a subtle wall of stuff. So. And there was aversion to that count. The number 8 kept coming up. Bubble of thought 8. No. Bubble of thought 8. So I just said, oh, forget it.
Thanks. Yeah.
I kind of had the opposite. I thought I was kind of concentrated, and when you asked us to do that, I started reacting to the stimulus and the sounds and things, and I just felt I had to notice them.
It felt it was distracting to you to try to do that. Yeah. Maybe a little too much effort or something, or just, yeah, interesting. Anyone else have any comments? Yeah?
I was surprised by, I noticed thoughts, but I was struck by how many images popped up.
That's part of what I wanted to check in with people about. Did people notice different types of thoughts? Did they hear sounds, or did they see pictures as thoughts? Did people have that kind of experience of seeing images? Not so many images. You had some images? Did a lot of people have an experience of hearing their thoughts? Yeah. Is it like you're talking to yourself? Yes. So, okay, yeah, that's a common one. Yeah. Anybody hear thoughts as if they were kind of impersonal? Like listening to a radio? Anybody have that kind of experience? Yeah. Anybody have any other kinds of experiences they're interested in sharing? Yeah, it's an exercise. Yeah, this is just an exercise to introduce you to what it's like to observe the thoughts. So it's not something I'd recommend that you do in your meditation normally. It's really just an exercise to begin to see what our thinking process is like, to interrupt and to begin to observe the thinking process. So counting is a way to do that. So yeah, it is a kind of an extra added thing to the meditation. So.
This problem of being very self-referential, like I had someone say to me before I started doing the lesson, it's like, well, in your meditation, just when you see a thought come up, just label it a thought and then make up. So then you think about labeling something a thought and you think about thinking about the subject.
Yeah, it can get that. Sometimes when I do this guided meditation, I say you don't have to count the counting. You know, that can get very quickly recursive. But it can feel that way sometimes, and the noting in particular, I know, can have that kind of a feeling that it's like extra thinking. But these techniques can be helpful sometimes. So sometimes the noting in particular is kind of like riding a bicycle, where it takes a while before the technique starts to flow with the practice, and you don't feel like it's kind of going at cross purposes to it. Working with thoughts in our practice. So part of the function of the mind is to produce thoughts, to think and to generate ideas. And another part of the function of the mind is to receive thoughts. So much as the eye receives sight or the ear receives sound, the mind also receives thoughts. So it can be helpful to look at thinking in that way. It's not quite so, it doesn't have to be so personal, our thoughts. It's just something the mind does. So thoughts happen. They're usually based on some causes and conditions. They can happen, and I'm sure you've noticed this kind of thing, that they result from experiences we've had in our day, maybe the last day or month or year. Thoughts can arise based out of those experiences. Thoughts can arise based on a mood or emotion that we're having. Or they might be based on somebody we've met. They can be based on sense impressions. And sometimes they can just seem to just come out of nowhere. When I was a kid, I liked to play this game with myself. We often took long trips in the car. And to entertain myself in these long trips, I would play this game in my mind where I would just let go of my thinking and not try to keep track of what I was thinking about, which I found was pretty easy to do. And then at some point, I would jump into the thought process and say, okay, what am I thinking about now? And that's where the game started. Okay, what am I thinking about now? And then I would try to figure out where this thought came from. And I would trace back. So I'd think, well, what was I thinking about? Or where did this thought come from? And I'd often recognize that there was some thought before that that had triggered it. And then I would think, well, where did that thought come from? And I'd think of another thought that triggered that. And as I followed this process back, I often noticed for myself that I think every time when I was a child, I noticed that they always came ultimately from sense impressions, something I'd seen outside of the window as we were driving. And I loved playing this game to see where my thoughts had come from. I thought I had found the source of thoughts, you know, that thoughts didn't, I began to realize thoughts didn't just come into the mind spontaneously. They seemed to be related to sense impressions. Well, I've since discovered, actually, that sometimes thoughts can come spontaneously into the mind. But a large majority of our thoughts are based on our sense experiences. And then, actually, a large majority of our thoughts, as I discovered in the game that I played, are based on chaining off of that sense experience. Thoughts lead to thoughts, lead to thoughts, lead to thoughts, and we create a whole world of thoughts from seeing a tree outside the car window. And much of our life results from a kind of a reactivity to these thoughts, and some of which aren't even conscious in our minds. We have a tendency to believe our thoughts, or at least think that they say something about us. So if we have a weird thought or a strange thought that arises, we might think, wow, I must be a bad person to have such a thought. Or if a novel, unique thought arises, we might think, wow, I'm a really creative person to have such a thought. So our work in mindfulness practice is not necessarily to still the thinking, to have a quiet mind. But what the mindfulness helps us to do is to begin to make thoughts conscious. In this process of making the thoughts conscious, we can begin to see how we react to the thoughts, and we can begin to see habitual patterns that are triggered off of thoughts. And as we start to see the reactivity, we can begin to get some space around that reactivity and begin to see that we actually don't have to react to our thoughts. So I'd like to take a moment to distinguish between the contents of thinking and the process of thinking. So the contents of thinking are pretty much what we're all familiar with, what he said, what she said, what I did, what I'm going to do, what I'd like to do. The process of thinking is how thinking happens in the mind. So what I was trying to suggest you observe with the counting process is how the thoughts come up in the mind. Are they visual? Are they auditory? So thoughts can be have many different flavors. The visual quality, they can maybe appear like still photographs. They might appear like a movie. They might appear as just little bits and pieces of images. You might hear sounds with the pictures. It might be like a whole full-blown movie running in your mind. But often the thoughts are auditory. We experience, I think the most common way that I experience thinking in my daily life is as if I'm talking to myself. But I also sometimes do experience thinking as something very impersonal. Sometimes thoughts just seem like they're completely unrelated to me, particularly in meditation, and it's just like there's some radio going, and I have no understanding or interest or knowledge of what's being thought about. It's just something that's arising in the mind. So thoughts can sometimes have that really impersonal quality to them also. So in the meditation, we can also notice not only what the thoughts are like, whether they're visual or auditory, but we can notice how they appear, how they persist, how they change, how they disappear. And also sometimes a slight attention to the content can give you an understanding about how the mind works. So the associative nature of thoughts is very common. To have thoughts chain one off of another. Sometimes it seems like there's just one long, huge thought, but really it's probably broken into a bunch of thoughts that are chaining one off of each other. Another thing that's sometimes interesting to pay attention to with thoughts is, if it's an auditory thought, is the tone of voice of the thought. So is it an angry voice or a happy voice or a frustrated voice? That can sometimes give you some clues about what's going on in connection with the thinking. When we attend to the process of thinking, we start to see that thoughts actually don't last very long. They're very ephemeral. They're very light. They're almost nothing. There's just a fleeting image in the mind. There's a fleeting moment of sound in the mind, and it's gone. And then another one comes up. Thoughts have very little power. Thoughts have the power that we give them. They really are almost nothing, just empty. But if we believe our thoughts, they have huge power over us, especially when we're not aware of them as thoughts. They can rule our lives, sending us careening off into reactivity and plans and thoughts. And we're not really aware that we're responding to the thinking. So in the mindfulness practice, as I said, we're not really trying to stop this thinking process, but to make it conscious so that we have some sort of choice in how we react or whether we react to the thinking process. So for a little while now, I'd like to talk some about working with thoughts in meditation. That's a place where people often get frustrated with thinking. And it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. So I'd like to just talk a little bit about working with thoughts in the meditation. And probably one of the more common experiences in meditation is that people find that they've just drifted away from whatever they were paying attention to. They've drifted away from the present moment into some floating thinking process. It's not particularly grabbing us, but we're just kind of thinking about, oh, what we had for lunch or what we're going to do when we get home. It's not particularly emotionally charged, but it's just a drifting. And we weren't particularly aware that we'd lost the object of attention. So when you wake up in the midst of this kind of thinking, usually it's enough to simply notice that you're thinking, drifting or wandering, and let it go. There's no need to sustain thinking to observe it. You can simply just let it go and come back to whatever your object of attention was. Other times, though, one thing I'd just like to suggest for some of you, maybe, something you can try. I don't do this very often because it's kind of effortful, but if you pay very, very close attention to whatever your object of meditation is, if it's the breathing process, pay really, really close attention. See if you can catch the entire series of sensations all the way through the in-breath and then all the way through the out-breath. And keep track of where you are in that breathing process. At some point, the mind will leave it. And if you're paying very close attention to the breath, you'll begin to see when the mind leaves the breath. You'll actually see the thinking begin to happen. And it's a really interesting place to observe. Like I say, I don't suggest that you do this very often, but maybe at the end of your sitting, for a minute or two at the end of the sitting, see what happens if you try to focus very closely on the breath and see if you can notice when the thought arose. You may not catch that right at the direct moment the thought arises, but you may know that you're still on the same breath. That you know, it couldn't have been very long. Maybe it was a split second because you knew you had caught the beginning of that breath. So that's just something you can play with. Lots of times, though, thoughts are more compelling. They grab hold of us. They catch us. We find that we are not simply drifting off into them, but we're actively engaged in the thinking process while we're trying to meditate. And we notice that, and we think, oh, let go, and try to come back to the breath. And a moment later, we're off on that same theme over and over again. And so after this happens a few times, it can be helpful to look more closely at the thinking itself, to pay direct attention to the thinking process. One of the ways you can do this is to see if there's a particular theme to the content of the thought. So it might be planning or remembering or fantasizing or arguing or some kind of type of theme. And if you can just name the theme in a simple word, it can help to cut the engagement with the content. So you can try that. Another thing that's helpful to do when thinking is very strong like that and it just keeps pulling us is to see if there's some kind of physical response in the body as a result of the thinking. If thoughts are strong, there will probably be some manifestation in the body. There may be a contraction around the eyes or a tightening in the jaw, or a buzzing, a feeling like there's just these hundred of bumblebees rolling around in your head. There's probably some kind of physical manifestation of the thinking process itself. So you can turn your attention to the physical sensations, and that often helps to also cut the momentum of being pulled into this kind of compelling or obsessive type of thinking. Another thing to look for with thoughts is whether there's any emotion underneath them. Often when thoughts are that strong, there's some kind of emotion going on. And what's really happening is the emotion wants attention, or at least in my experience, what seems to be happening is that the emotion wants attention, and it's trying as hard as it can to get your attention by sending all these thoughts out. And it's not necessarily that the mind really wants you to pay attention to those thoughts. It's just trying to get you to pay attention to the emotion. So if you can notice the emotion that's happening and pay attention to that, often the thought streams settle down because that's really what the emotion wants, is the attention to say, oh, yes, I'm angry. I'm angry. Oh, this is anger. Or I'm happy. I've had experiences where the mind is off spinning into incredible stories, and I realize what's happening is that I'm happy and I've missed it. I've completely missed that I was happy because I was off in this stream of thoughts. So if we can identify the emotion that's underneath the thought, we can often, the stream of thoughts kind of dies down and we're left with the emotion. So attending to thoughts in our meditation is really helpful, but it's also helpful to pay attention to thoughts in our day. And one of the ways I found this extremely powerful in my own practice and noticing thoughts, noticing how thoughts really trigger reactivity, has been a huge lesson for me in my daily practice. And I'll tell one experience, one story of this. And it was fairly early in my practice, and I was a boyfriend had just broken up with me, and I was going to bed each night, and I was really lonely every night that I went to bed. And since I was practicing observing, I was using this particular loneliness as a thing to observe each night. And I'd like to suggest this for you, actually. I find often that picking something that it seems to be repeating in my life and dedicating myself to wake up when that thing happens is very powerful. I've had several experiences where it was very powerful to do this kind of a, I use it as a kind of a mindfulness bell. So in this case, I was watching the loneliness as I got into bed each night. And it didn't particularly surprise me that I was lonely getting into bed at night. I mean, I thought I knew why I was lonely going to bed at night. My boyfriend had broken up with me. I was single. I was going to bed alone. I mean, I was sad. It made perfect sense I would be lonely. But I was just observing. And so each night I would just notice the loneliness. And after some nights of observing this, I noticed one night that the loneliness arose when I was setting my alarm clock. And I thought, that's kind of odd. And so I just kept watching, and for several nights I noticed it come up as I set the alarm clock. And then one night while I was setting the alarm clock, it's a little tiny digital alarm clock I had, I noticed while I was setting the alarm clock a fleeting image go through the mind. And that image was an image of myself with my ex-boyfriend in Disneyland looking up at a marquee that had a digital clock on it. And so I could see that there was a connection between the physical sense impression, like I noticed when I was a child, the physical sense impression of the clock, and the memory that had the digital clock in it. And I noticed that the loneliness was a reaction to that thought. So the loneliness wasn't particularly there waiting for me as I got into bed. It was arising in the moment based on a reaction to a thought that had arisen because of a sense impression. That was like, wow, that's amazing. You know, I was amazed at the power of mindfulness to uncover the source of an emotion in a thought that I barely saw. Just a fleeting, fleeting image. It was there and gone. But what was even more surprising for me was the next few nights, or the next night actually, as I went to bed, as I set my alarm clock, I was waiting for the loneliness because the memory was conscious, you know. It's like I remembered the night before, I remembered the thought. The thought was there, and the loneliness did not arise. And that surprised me. I understand it now that what happened was that the recognition of the connection between the loneliness and the thought, that the thought had triggered the loneliness, sort of cut the power of that thought to generate the reactivity. And I didn't try to do this. I mean, I was stunned that the reactivity did not arise. So for me, this kind of paying attention and being able to notice the arising of thought like that has been very powerful in my own practice. There are also other ways that we can pay attention to thoughts. This just came up in a little discussion we were having right before the group here, that during our day, it's not necessarily that we can be quite so right attentive to our detailed arisings of thoughts, but we can be attentive to the general theme of what's happening. Are we planning? Are we remembering? Are we distracted? And that can help to usher us back into the present moment and perhaps if we're working, back into the task at hand. So we can be generally mindful of what our thinking is about and what we're doing. I find that this is something, particularly in my line of work where I deal with computers and writing about computer code, that it's hard to be conscious of the thoughts because the thoughts have to kind of go in order to produce the work. But to just be generally aware of the idea of, okay, working or thinking or distracted. Oh, I'm off thinking about yesterday. To just bring that kind of awareness to our thinking process in our day. So sometimes it can be difficult to be mindful of thoughts. And the emotion or the obsessive nature of the thoughts is so strong that the mindfulness just gets lost, that we just get sucked right in. No matter what we think or try, I'm going to be mindful of this, we get lost. So I'd like to talk a little bit about paying attention or working with thoughts when it's difficult to be mindful of them. And the Buddha gave a discourse on 5 ways to remove distracting thoughts. And mostly he was talking about in a concentration practice, in a meditation practice where we're trying to focus on one thing and we find distracting thoughts keep us from that theme. Here are 5 techniques that we can use to deal with these kinds of thoughts. But I find this list is very interesting and is actually something that we can use in our daily life as well. So I'd like to go over it with you. So there are 5 ways that he talks about. Oh, and one other thing I'd just like to mention before I go into the 5 ways. This is not really counter to the whole practice that the Buddha taught. There's the mindfulness practice, which is, you know, paying attention to what happens as it happens. But the Buddha taught a larger picture, and one of the aspects of the larger picture is called right effort. And part of right effort is not only cultivating wholesome states like mindfulness. The mindfulness practice is really part of that, cultivating wholesome qualities of mind. But another aspect of right effort is letting go of unwholesome or unskillful things. And so these techniques that the Buddha is talking about really fall into that category of letting go of the unskillful when we see we're really caught by it. So there are 5 ways to for removing distracting thoughts, so the Buddha says. And the first is called replacing the thought. And I'll read you a little bit of what the Buddha says about this. There is the case when unskillful thoughts arise while you are referring to and attending to a particular theme. You should attend to another theme. While attending to this other theme, unskillful thoughts are abandoned and subside. Just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice would use a small peg to knock out a larger one, in the same way, if unskillful thoughts arise, you should attend to another theme. So this is the idea of replacing thoughts. And the classic example or classic practice taught for this is metta. And this is a practice of actively cultivating positive thoughts in the mind. And it's really given as an antidote to aversive mind states. The metta is described as an antidote to aversive mind states. So if there are lots of angry thoughts or aversive thoughts or thoughts of ill will in the mind, you can try this, replacing the thoughts with positive thoughts. May I be happy? May I be peaceful? May I live with ease? May I be free from suffering? Or if you're angry at someone else, to direct the thoughts, the metta, to that person. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. And this isn't just running the thoughts like a mantra in the mind. It's actually thinking the thoughts, really connecting with the meaning of the thought. And it's okay if you don't feel what the meaning says. Just think about the meaning and say the thoughts. And that form of replacing the thought can be very powerful. Now, I have to say that this was very hard for me initially, and I could not do this. So if it doesn't work for you, let it go. So the second technique the Buddha describes is attending to the drawbacks of the thought. So here's what he has to say about this. If unskillful thoughts still arise, scrutinize the drawbacks of those thoughts. Truly, these thoughts of mind are unskillful. These thoughts result in stress. Just as a young woman or man fond of adornment would be horrified, humiliated, or disgusted if the carcass of a snake or dog were hung from his or her neck, in the same way, if unskillful thoughts arise, you should scrutinize the drawbacks of those thoughts.
Finding that loving, that warm kind of feeling, that, or, you know, with respect to, you know, addressing lust. So, you know, I mean, you say, think thoughts of, like, you know, what the body is made of and stuff like that, but it's more kind of digging down to, like, the aversion and, like, the really kind of picky feelings, but, like, kind of at more of a visceral level than that.
Well, that's true. But initially, often people find that as they're practicing these practices, the metta in particular, that there isn't any feeling that's there. And that doesn't mean that the practice isn't working. So, you know, that you may feel some of those feelings, and that's great, and you can connect to the feeling. If you can connect to the feeling and the thought at the same time, it's extremely powerful. But it's also powerful just connecting to the thought and knowing the meaning of the thought. So that's why I mentioned that it's not necessary. So attending to the drawbacks. For me, this was helpful in working with anger. And so attending to the drawbacks, you know, anger is something that hurts me, actually, not the person that I'm directing it at. And I found at one point I was really, really angry at somebody. And in this particular situation, I was in the Peace Corps. And the person that I was angry with, I was in the South Pacific, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And the person that I was angry with was 7,000 miles away in California. And it became obvious, actually. It took longer than I might have imagined. But it did become obvious that the anger did not somehow reach across that 7,000 miles of ocean and get him in California. And so, you know, I began to realize how painful the anger was in this body and that it really hurt me. It did nothing to him. And so that was really helpful to help me begin to learn to actually want to let go of the anger. I think often we want our anger to continue because we do have these beliefs that it somehow reverberates out and somehow gets the person that we're angry with. So attending to the drawbacks. Another experience I had with anger was at one point I recognized about a person that I was angry with was the desire for him to be injured, physically injured in some way. And that, in that moment of seeing that desire, in the context of the anger, that desire made perfect sense. But I also saw that that desire, that movement towards wanting to physically harm him, was the seeds of war in my own mind. It mushroomed out very quickly to seeing this is how war begins. And that served a couple purposes for me. Again, it was seeing the drawback of the thought. It really brought the thought and the anger up short to see the consequences of that kind of thinking. But it also served to generate some compassion for just how hard it is to be a human being in this world and why there is so much suffering. The third technique is ignoring the thoughts. And here's what he says on this one. If unskillful thoughts still arise, pay no mind and no attention to those thoughts. Just as a man with good eyes, not wanting to see forms that had come into range, would close his eyes and look away, just in the same way. So, ignoring the thought. And again, I'll give an example from my own practice on how I worked with this. And this is really just turning the attention away from the thought. The thought may sort of continue in the background, but you're not putting your primary attention on the thought. Just ignore it. It's okay to leave it in the background. And for me, again, another anger example. I have a lot of anger examples. I was working with, over a long period of time, with anger at this ex-boyfriend that broke up with me. And over the course of years, I was watching the anger just come up over in daily life. Day after day, I would notice something would happen that I would notice that the anger came up. And I began to recognize that the anger was strong enough that the mindfulness wasn't really able to meet it. And I would just get pulled in. And so I really began to see, this isn't skillful. You know, trying to pay attention to actually observe and look at the anger isn't so skillful because I get sucked into it. So why don't I just look at something else? So just as a man would turn away his eyes and look at something else, I turned my attention to a neutral object. So if I was walking down the street, I would start to pay attention to my feet on the ground. Or if I was sitting at my desk at work, I'd start to pay attention to my butt in the chair. So I would just remove it's like a not now. You know, it wasn't with aversion to say, I hate this. It was a sense of, this isn't skillful and my mindfulness isn't strong enough for this. Not now. Maybe someday when my mindfulness is stronger, I'll be able to look at this directly, but not now. So it was putting it aside without aversion and just attending to something neutral. And in this case, I didn't try to attend to something positive, but just something very basic, very neutral. And over the course of a long time, a couple of years, this anger slowly died down and finally actually completely died away without my ever actually needing to look at it directly. It was surprising actually. One day I noticed that the anger was gone what I noticed actually was that the anger hadn't come up in a long time. And I began to think about thoughts about my ex-boyfriend and the anger didn't come up. And I was like, wow, where did it go? Is it here? And it didn't seem to be. I didn't really trust that it was gone, but that day really was the recognition that it was gone. And it has never come back. And in fact, it's now been replaced by metta. I feel metta for him now. So that simple recognition, oh, I'm angry, I can't be with this, let me just let go of it and pay attention to something else, over the course of years was extremely powerful. It really allowed it to very slowly, very gradually wind itself out. So I found that to be, that ignoring has been very helpful for me. The fourth kind of way to work with thoughts, to remove distracting thoughts, is relaxing the formation of the thoughts. Now this one's a little strange, but and I'm not sure there's real agreement on what it means, but I'll read what it says. If unskillful thoughts still arise, You should attend to the relaxing the formation of the thoughts. Just as a thought would occur to a man walking quickly, why am I walking quickly? Why don't I walk slowly? So he walks slowly. Then the thought occurs to him, why am I walking slowly? Why don't I stand? So he stands. The thought occurs to him, why am I standing? Why don't I sit down? So he sits down. The thought occurs to him, why am I sitting? Why don't I lie down? So he lies down. In this way, giving up the grosser posture, he takes up the more refined one. So, as I said, I'm not sure there's complete agreement about what this means, but in the notes in the back of the sutta for this particular piece, it talks about noticing the cause of the thoughts. And so the way I look at this is to look at the layers. Thoughts are built layer upon layer upon layer, and often actually those layers are connected to emotions. And so I really look at this as kind of uncovering the layers of emotions behind our thoughts. So for instance, one experience I had of this, a series of layers that I uncovered, was that I started out having very strong doubting thoughts about I shouldn't be doing this practice. And in staying with and recognizing those thoughts of doubt, I finally recognized there were thoughts about fear that I'm not measuring up to this practice. And under the fear was a feeling of unworthiness. I'm not worth this practice. I'm not good enough to do this practice. And under the a feeling of unworthiness, there was a feeling of insecurity about my financial situation, that I don't have the money to be spending on these retreats. You know, I'm not able to dedicate my life to this practice because it's too expensive. And then under the insecurity, or along with the insecurity, actually was a very strong aversion to the insecurity. And that's really where the reactivity was born out of, was that aversion to the insecurity. And as I began to be able to just be with the insecurity, I realized there was a feeling of vulnerability underneath that. And as I touched the vulnerability, I realized, oh, this is just a human experience of vulnerability. And at that point, the whole sort of stream of thoughts that had been cascading off of, you know, emotion built on top of emotion, it died down. So that's my understanding of some of how this relaxing the formation of the thoughts were to just be with. It's a kind of mindfulness to notice where you are and what might be right underneath it. It's a little bit of investigating. What's underneath this? What's triggering this? And the last of the techniques I mentioned with some trepidation, I will read this. If unskillful thoughts still arise, so this is really, you know, supposed to be in order. You start with the replacing. If that doesn't work, you go to attending to the drawbacks. If that doesn't work, you go to ignoring. If that doesn't work, you go to relaxing the formation of the thoughts. If none of those work, here's what the Buddha suggests. Then with teeth clenched and tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush his mind with his awareness. Just as a strong man seizing a weaker man by the head or the throat or the shoulders would beat him down, constrain and crush him in the same way. So again, there is some discussion about what this actually means. But the way I look at this, And I think, you know, I heard one talk about this where the teacher says, you know, I just don't believe that the Buddha was telling us to hate our thoughts. But the way I understand this really is that it's a very strong no. You really begin to see how a series of thoughts leads you into suffering, and you just realize no, and say no, just say no. It's like you might say no to a child who is getting ready to stick their hand in a fire. When you see that motion happening, out of concern and compassion for the child, not out of anger and hatred for the child, but out of concern and compassion for their well-being, you say, no, stop! And the child is frightened and they pull their hand back. So it's that kind of movement of mind, the recognition of that the mind is headed somewhere where it's going to cause suffering, and you say, stop, no. I don't have a lot of suggestions on how to practice with that, but experiment if you find yourself getting to that point and see what happens.
Yeah. Just offer maybe to say that crushing doesn't have to be associated with hating. If you crush garbage when you put it in the trash.
That's true.
And so you just aren't associated with the thing you're crushing then.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, that can be a helpful analogy. Yeah.
I heard a similar one too about that, is it drawing a black X on it.
Ah, that's a nice one.
Yeah.
To say,
like, I'm not going to entertain this thought. I'm just going to draw a black X on it. And that's for repetitive thought. You can't handle it in another way.
Right. And another way that I've heard it talked about is, one of my teachers said, I will note this thought every time it arises, you know, to really put the mind there to catch that thought as it comes up so that you can say no to it. So those are my thoughts. We've got, yeah.
Do we really have to get rid of all the thoughts that we might think they are unskillful, but in reality they are not? And it's the reaction of just trying to get rid of them by one of those five or four steps.
Well, okay, I'll.
Or also, you have to say there are some other positive reactions that is necessary to say. Maybe the
thought
is just the disease of some
better. Yes. So a couple of things to respond. So the first part of your question was, what are unskillful thoughts? And typically, unskillful is defined as anything that stems out of greed, aversion, or delusion. So that's the basic definition, that if you can see the motivation or the intention behind the thought is stemming out of greed, aversion or hatred, or delusion, then it's probably something you should pay attention to. And the other piece, the last piece where I was talking about where the Buddha talks about the removal of thoughts, it really does kind of point to the direction of getting rid of thoughts in our meditation. But as I was saying, this is really taught for a concentration practice where you do want to still the mind and bring it back to some point of concentration. In the mindfulness practice, we don't necessarily do that. And what we do, as I was talking about earlier in the practice, is we make our thoughts conscious. And as we make our thoughts conscious, what we can begin to see is the motivation that surrounds the thought. We can see the underlying emotion that comes with the thought, and we can really start to see, is this something I want to act on, or is it something I want to let go of? So the mindfulness really helps to uncover all of this so that we can choose how to respond, so that we're not just, you know, responding to our thoughts subconsciously, but they're conscious so that we can choose. So that's... It is, and I find mindfulness is very, very helpful in this, that it's instead of actually thinking through the thoughts, because the thinking process can kind of add complexity. And so if you can hold the thoughts in mindfulness, look in your body, you'll begin to uncover a kind of an intuitive knowledge, an intuition that can give you more information about the thought than the thinking or the analyzing process would. So there's definitely room for the thinking process and analyzing, why am I thinking this thought and where will it lead me to actually reflect on the thinking. But we're so familiar with that. You know, we don't really need training in that piece. So what I'm suggesting is that we explore the possibility or the potential of simple awareness to guide us into a more intuitive understanding of where these thoughts come from and a more intuitive understanding of the intention behind the thoughts. And I think you may find that it's a rich world of knowledge that we're not very familiar with. So it's a suggestion to really open our understanding to a more multidimensional way of analyzing. Yeah.
Thank you, first of all, for this lecture on thoughts. It's very timely for me. And I have a question, but I'd like to provide some context to it. I'm a novice student to meditation, but I find myself looking forward to sitting there, which I sit and I wake up and I sit on my cushion. Can't wait to get home to sit on my cushion. Before I go to bed, I sit on my cushion. But I think I'm going about it the wrong way. So my question is there a wrong way to meditate? Is there meditating in such a way that brings harm to one's mind or self or spirit? Because when I sit with the, from the little that I read, I know that people are supposed to sit to quiet their mind. I can't wait to sit and think. I wake up and I just sit and I want to think about my day. I get home and I sit in my cushion and I can't, and I just want to think about what happened at work. And most often I find myself thinking of certain images and consciously, so consciously bring forth an image, and it's usually a difficulty with someone.
Mm-hmm.
And just it's almost like a visualization. I bring him up in front of me and then I think about it. And I talk this out with a friend who's not a novice meditator. She tells me that this is totally wrong and it could harm me. And could you respond to that?
What I would suggest, I mean, it doesn't really sound like, you're sitting on the cushion. That's really a good thing. If nothing else, it is stilling the body and letting you see the thinking that's happening. But one thing you could try is to see if you can not necessarily try to stop the thinking, because it sounds like that's what's happening. I don't know, are you actively trying to think, or is that just what happens when you sit down?
Actively.
You actually want to think. Okay. Maybe what you could try is allow yourself to sit down sometimes and do that kind of practice. It's a different kind of practice. It's not a mindfulness practice. It's more of a reflective practice where you're thinking about things. You could take one of those times, since you sit down three times a day, and try to, instead of doing the thinking, see if you can notice what it feels like to want to think. See if you can pay attention to that desire to think. And just see what it feels like in the body. What's the motivation behind that wanting to think? It may be a wholesome motivation, in which case, you know, that gives you some understanding of what the process is happening in you. It may be that you don't want to be with the silence, which is maybe a little bit of an aversive reaction. So if you can just take 5 minutes out of one of those periods and see if you can just notice that wanting to think. What does it feel like to want to think? Turn the attention away from the thoughts and bring it back to yourself and see what that feels like. And see if it uncovers anything new for you, any new realms of experience. Another way I'd like to suggest that you try to work with thoughts is there's an actual reflective practice that I found helpful at times where rather than actually actively thinking through something, what we do is we start by calming the mind, concentrating the mind. Just spend even 2 or 3 minutes focusing on the breathing. And then have a question or something you want to pay attention to, like this image of this person you were talking about. Have that kind of ready as something to drop into that silence. So if you can let go of the thinking for a while and let yourself get calm a little bit through the thinking, and then let that thought drop into that quiet. And then don't try to think about it, but see what comes up from underneath. See what response happens from underneath. There'll probably be thoughts. There will probably be thought reactions. Notice what those thoughts are, acknowledge them, and then go back to the quiet and let that first image come back again and see what the response is. This is another way to get a more intuitive response to something you want to think about, as opposed to that kind of analyzing process. So you could try those things and see how they work for you. And it doesn't sound like you're harming yourself by doing what you're doing, but it might be helpful to try some different approaches to the thinking, to use more of the mindfulness and what the mindfulness and awareness can uncover around the thinking, because it's very powerful what it can uncover. Yeah?
Did you say the name of this sutta?
It is called the Vitakka Santhana Sutta. It's number 117 in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's called the removal of distracting thoughts. Any other comments? Well, we have 1 minute, so let's have a minute of silence. Thank you for your attention and participation.